Next case on our calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Eric Allen Grammans. Grammans? All right, Grammans it is. Council, while you are getting settled, I'll remind you each that you have 15 minutes to present your oral argument. Council, for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we are making an audio recording, and that is the only permitted recording of this oral argument. Finally, the podium can be raised or lowered to meet your needs, and there is a button in the middle underneath the podium itself. So with that, when you are ready, Counsel for Appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of Appellant Eric Allen Grammans. This court remanded Mr. Grammans' sentencing hearing for resentencing, and upon remand, the district court misinterpreted this court's remand order and misapplied the law, thus abusing its discretion. When this court remanded for resentencing, it directed the lower court to actually consider the trog factors. In the original sentencing order, the lower court did not consider or discuss any of the relevant factors regarding a dispositional departure. This court recognized that, despite the fact that they were argued by Mr. Grammans and counsel, the district court ignored those factors and, according to this court, departed based on one sole impermissible factor. On remand, this court did not direct the district court not to consider victim impact statements. It directed the district court to consider all of the relevant factors regarding a dispositional departure to probation and to analyze it appropriately and make a sentencing decision based on that.
And it seems to me that's what the district court did. I'm having a hard time understanding why this is a rare case in which we disturb a presumptive sentence.
So initially there was a departure given, but it was based on impermissible factors. And then if you look at the court's order here, the district court's order only goes over the trog factors. It doesn't list particular amenability to probation except for at the very end regarding the trog factors. It doesn't mention particular amenability to individualized treatment in a probationary setting. That's what trog is all about. In fact, in this order,
the district court imposing a presumptive sentence have to make those kind of findings?
No, but the record needs to indicate that it did weigh the factors for and against a departure. And that's exactly what it failed to do the first time around, which is why this court remanded and gave it.
Well, it seems to me the first time around, the district court made its decision based on a finding of amenability to probation. And that is not the standard. And that is why this court reversed and remanded. Here, the district court made a departure, you know, made a finding and said not particularly amenable, and noted at the hearing and the order that it considered all of the information submitted again by the party. So again, given the fact the district court doesn't have to make any findings at all, what is your strongest argument that the district court abused its discretion here?
My strongest argument that the district court abused its discretion is that it failed to consider relevant factors such as public safety, particular unamenability to incarceration, and most importantly, the victim impact statements and how they related to relevant departure grounds. This court was under the impression, the incorrect impression, that it could not consider these victim impact statements. And that's clearly laid out in the court's order. When the defense attorney at resentencing tried to explain to the district court that under State v. Yanez, you're permitted to consider victim impact statements as a factor for a departure so long as it relates to a relevant departure ground. The district court's order specifically noted that the Court of Appeals did not cite Yanez in its opinion remanding this case. The district court's order specifically says that, yes, if it is an appropriate departure factor, a court may rely on a victim impact statement. If
is the victim's here express preference that your client go to jail as opposed to prison? Is that a Is that a proper departure ground?
Not that alone, Your Honor, no. But the victim impact statements here related to many relevant departure grounds. The concerns of the victims related to Mr. Grommets's particular unamenability to prison. Both victims and other family members explained to the court that there is no way that Mr. Grommets can hide his police tattoos. He has two very large, prominent police tattoos, one a thin blue line just above his elbow, and another a police shield with a thin blue line on his upper bicep. He also has his daughter's names tattooed, the two victims' names tattooed on him. His daughters expressed fear for what would happen to their father in prison as a police officer who cannot hide his status, and also as a police officer convicted of a registrable sex offense. That's a permissible factor. In addition, the particular amenability to individualized treatment in a probationary setting, it doesn't demonstrate that the judge considered this at all on remand. There was extensive evidence about Mr. Grommets' success on probation during that entire year between his sentencing hearings. He had completed a full polygraph disclosure and passed it. He had he was set to complete an 18-month treatment program in 12 months. This is exceptional performance on probation. He had no violations, had never missed a meeting, never missed a phone call with his agent, and was going above and beyond the conditions of his probation. And in State v. Soto, the Supreme Court laid out what it means to be particularly amenable to probation. And that means that you need to be exceptional or somewhat particularly different than other people who are similarly situated. Comparing Mr. Grommets to other people convicted of the same offense making a dispositional departure motion and all of the circumstances surrounding his motion and his case clearly demonstrate that he is an exceptional candidate for probation and individualized treatment in a community-based setting. The psychosexual evaluation found him a low risk to offend.
Well, that was done even before he entered his guilty plea, wasn't it?
Correct.
And before he even acknowledged. In fact, I think he denied to the evaluator abusing his younger daughter.
That's correct in the initial psychosexual.
Right.
And that demonstrates that he was able to be rehabilitated in this short period of time through treatment. Some of the arguments that the state makes in respondent's brief about inconsistencies in Mr. Grommets' statements are actually his disclosures over time, when he was originally arrested for this offense, when he originally had the psychosexual evaluation. He had never been treated. The whole purpose of being rehabilitated on probation is that someone has something that needs to be worked on, that needs to be rehabilitated. If he had admitted everything and had nothing to work on in the beginning, maybe he wouldn't be particularly amenable. But the record demonstrates that he continued to make more disclosures in treatment.
Even if we agree with you that there would be a record to support a finding of particular amenability, does that require a district court to depart?
It doesn't require a district court to depart. But what requires remand in this case is the district court's misapplication of this court's order on remand and its misunderstanding of the law. That is an abuse of discretion. The district court did not understand what it was to consider in determining Mr. Grommets' particular amenability. It felt it could not consider the victim impact statements. It disregarded those.
I don't see that in the order. And I'm looking at the memorandum attached to the order that seems to go through a number of the arguments, the trog factors. I'm not sure I understand how your argument that the district court didn't consider the victim impact statements.
Yes, Your Honor. At sentencing, the district court told the victims that this was not on them. This was a purely legal decision, and he had to do what the Court of Appeals directed him to do. He told the victims at the conclusion of this sentencing hearing, I've been told what I did wrong, and the Court of Appeals told me what I need to do to correct it.
Right, to apply the right standard, particular amenability, not amenability.
And then she further tells the victims, this is not about you, this is about the law. And then if you look at the court's sentencing order on remand, and you note on page 8, the only acknowledgement to this victim impact statement is page 8, where it discusses how a trial court may consider a victim impact statement to the extent it's a proper reason and is corroborated by evidence in the record. If it satisfies these conditions, then the court can consider it as a factor supporting a departure from the guidelines. It drops a footnote here explaining, yes, Yanez was an upward departure case, and noting the Court of Appeals did not mention Yanez in its opinion in this matter, indicating sometimes Yanez says it's appropriate to consider these statements, but in this case, the Court of Appeals remanding the case back to me, telling me I inappropriately considered the victim impact statements, did not cite to Yanez. This demonstrates that the district court felt her hands were tied. She couldn't consider the victim impact statements to the extent even that they related to valid departure grounds.
Counsel, can you then explain on page 9 at the end, the district court then goes into a paragraph talking about, again, the victim impact. I'm trying to understand. Your argument is that the district court didn't consider victim impact. Page 8, before the footnote, the district court says that they may consider victim impact, and then on page 9, in fact, lays out the victim impact. Isn't that a demonstration that the district court, in fact, did consider victim impact?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Excuse me, it's not. And that's because, again, on page 8, it said it may if appropriate. This court told it was not appropriate to do so in this case, and that's why it dropped the Yanez footnote. And additionally, when you look at the one mention of victims on page 9, that's the family support piece. He indicates that he does have the support of his daughters and former wife, victims of the offense, to the extent they don't desire him to go to prison. That is not sufficient to consider the full extent of the victim impact statement. It related to valid departure grounds outside of just family support. It related to his particular amenability to probation and individualized treatment in a probationary setting, and it definitely related to his particular unamenability to incarceration.
On that point, you cite us to, I think, the Wright, State versus Wright.
Correct.
Which involved particular unamenability. And that involved a person with psychiatric problems who would be abused in prison, basically would not be able to function. We don't have those facts in this case, do we?
No, we don't. But we have striking similarities regarding the particular unamenability of Mr. Grommets, although he didn't have the mental health concerns that the defendant Wright had.
So it's because he was a police officer for 18 years.
Not only that. That is a huge part of it. But it's not about his employment. It's about the fact that he, as a police officer on the force for 18 years, investigating crimes, having interactions with defendants, would be someone who's at risk already in prison. Additionally, because he has this status tattooed on his body in an extremely prominent place, a status of thin blue line tattoos that is recognizable no matter who you are as a police officer shield, he's not able to avoid that status in prison. This isn't about his employment. It's about who he is and what puts him at risk in prison. Additionally, the way to be rehabilitated as someone who's committed a sex offense in prison is to participate in prison-based sex offender treatment. He's not someone who would qualify for that. He will not, first of all, he was a low risk to reoffend, so he wouldn't qualify for treatment in prison anyway. Additionally, this is group therapy. There is no way that someone who is a police officer is going to be able to share his offenses with other inmates in prison in a safe environment. That's why not only is he unamenable to incarceration, it shows that he's particularly amenable to individualized treatment in a probationary setting. He is different than the standard person convicted of these offenses because of who he is, the individual characteristics of Mr. Grommets, and that's what we have to consider. What would be best for society and the individual characteristics of Mr. Grommets. Additionally, according to State v. Soto, a very important consideration is public safety. And public safety needs to be considered when determining what's best for Mr. Grommets and society. And it's clear that what's best for public safety in this case is him being rehabilitated on probation, getting the individualized treatment that he needs in the community. You saw we have the benefit of seeing how he was supervised on probation, seeing the strides that he made while on probation. He passed a full disclosure polygraph within 12 months of being placed on probation, which means he went from not disclosing everything in his initial psychosexual to disclosing everything through treatment and working through treatment with these things. the court was provided with a detailed treatment plan that Mr. Grommets was already engaged in. This was supported by his family, his friends, and the court's order on remand, it's very minimal. I would argue that it doesn't...
And again, isn't that because a district court imposing a presumptive sentence doesn't have to make findings?
No, but I would argue in this situation, when the district court did impose a dispositional departure and then was told that you need to carefully consider the record by this court, that careful consideration should include an indication of what they considered.
Counsel, why does page 3 and page 4 of the order not consider that? So looking at page 3 of the district court's order, it starts by outlining the victim's discussion. It talks about the polygraph and him passing that, but then it talks about the testimony of Jared Tabor, and in essence, it goes into the very information you are arguing it didn't consider, that he was making very good progress, that he was a low risk to offend. It seems to me that just articulates that the district court considered it, and it seems to me that they just disregarded it or decided it didn't reach the threshold for departure. Why isn't that sufficient when the district court specifically outlines the information that you're talking about here?
In the facts section of the court's order here, these are just the findings of fact, it acknowledged the testimony that was presented. Excuse me, I see my time has run. May I briefly respond? It acknowledged the testimony that was presented and then had a memorandum of law about the factors it actually relied on. And it's clear from this order that it felt bound by this court's remand order that it could only consider the trog factors. There are other factors that go to particular amenability to individualized treatment in a probationary setting. And Mr. Grommets absolutely met that in this case. And the court's failure to fully consider these was an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Johnson. I represent the state of Minnesota in this appeal. A court must impose a sentence within the guidelines unless there are substantial and compelling reasons to support a departure. In making that determination, a district court has broad discretion to depart or not to depart, and this court should not and has indicated that it will not interfere with that discretion, and that the district court only errs if they fail to consider legitimate and significant reasons for a departure. Even when mitigating factors are present, that does not mandate that the district court must impose a departure.
I understand that, counsel, but appellant's lawyer makes the point that this isn't a situation where that is at issue, but rather that the district court erred because it did not feel it was that it was able to consider any factors that would have suggested either particular amenability to probation or particular unamenability to prison because of the nature of the remand order. How do you respond to that argument?
I don't see that in the district court's order. The district court did acknowledge the remand, but I would also but went through the factors and gave consideration for things that were appropriate for the defendant, but also things that were inappropriate for the defendant. And what I would point to, Your Honors, is that in the first sentencing order, the court still did not find him particularly particularly amenable to probation. So it's not like the district court made one decision, had its hand slapped by the Court of Appeals and felt like it couldn't do anything different than what the Court of Appeals has already done. The district court had already determined that he was amenable, but not particularly amenable. That's not really feeling like their hands are tied.
Do you agree that particular unamenability to prison may be a valid departure ground?
It can be, but I would absolutely disagree with the use of it in this case for these circumstances.
Why? Can you explain that?
As I say in my brief, Your Honor, this does boil down to the appellant trying to say because of his occupation, he shouldn't get a prison sentence. And that is an unlawful departure ground under the sentencing guidelines.
Counsel, can you respond to opposing counsel's argument that it's not because of his occupation, but it's because of physical characteristics, that being the tattoos and the things that are, you know, fairly synonymous with who he is, that that is what makes him particularly unamenable to prison, not the fact that he was, in fact, a law enforcement officer?
I would say that's a slippery slope, Your Honor. In this situation, it's still very closely connected with his occupation. If the court were to reverse or remand on that ground, you're basically telling every police officer, hey, when you're facing a prison sentence, get a tattoo, you'll get out of jail for free. That should not be a way to get out of prison on a sentence that any other person who is not a police officer would get a prison sentence. And then let's take that further. Okay, if someone was facing a prison sentence, had a swastika, should that be a reason that they get out of prison because there may be people who don't like people with swastikas, or a person with a tattoo who's connected with a certain gang? Should they not have to go to prison because they'll be identified as one gang against another? Having a tattoo that makes it uncomfortable for you in prison should not be a reason for you to get out of prison when you do something that deserves for you to go to prison. In this case, merely being amenable to probation does not justify a departure from a presumptive sentence. Excuse me. For it to be a departure ground, a departure in this case, he would have had to be particularly amenable.
Doesn't the record of what happened between the first sentencing and the second sentencing, isn't that pretty strong evidence that he is particularly amenable to probation?
I would say, one, I don't know the stats on every single person who's been on probation, so I can't tell you for sure where he falls in the realm of just doing well on probation versus particularly. Remember, particular amenability is supposed to be rare. We're dealing with an individual here who has zero criminal history points. You would expect and hope for someone with zero criminal history points to at least do okay at treatment. But even if that is evidence that he was doing well at treatment, that does not mandate that the court should have departed in this case. Again, it is an abuse of discretion. The court did consider, as Judge Harris pointed out, in the facts, what was the testimony at the hearing. I don't think it should make a difference that it was in the findings of fact versus the memorandum. Clearly, the court considered it. Clearly, the court knew that was the evidence, and still determined that while, yes, he was amenable to probation, the judge could not find that he was particularly amenable. And, Your Honor, moving on to the victim impact statements, I would echo what Judge Harris pointed out, that the court did consider the victim impact statements. In the familial support, one of the TROG factors, did consider that the victims and his wife in this case wanted him not to be in prison and were concerned for his safety. So the court did consider it. The appellant points to the State v. Yanez case. But as I point out in my brief, they did not point out the exact language in Yanez. Yanez says that a victim impact statement can be used to support a